live from the cast of Hot in Cleveland.
Want to hear a joke?
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure.
What's the number one killer of women?
Well, you're still here, so that rules out crankiness.
And tracksuits.
Heart disease.
But that's a joke?
Oh, no, it's an absolute fact, but the American Heart Association says you can save lives by passing it along to five women you love.
Aww.
So I'm starting with three I tolerate. That's a joke.
Find out more at goredforwomen.org.
A very important key in keeping a healthy lifestyle is fitness. Why not condition yourself as well as your mind here at Henry Ford Community College? The health and physical education curriculum offers both a 2-year associate's in applied science as well as a certificate program, both offering a wide variety of courses including exercise physiology, nutrition, and physical conditioning. For more information, you can call 313-845-6318 or on the web at hfcc.edu/programs.
Welcome to WHFR. I am the Diva, and I would love for you to allow me to add a little heat to your Monday nights. Please join me for Lyrical Infusion every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m., where I blend the lyrics with the melodies to create magical moments of music just for you. Lyrical Infusion with the Diva, Mondays from 7 to 9 p.m., WHFR 89.3. Streaming live at WHFR.FM 24/7.
Looking for something to do on Saturday afternoons? Why not take a short trip to Redford and check out the Friends of the Redford Library book sale? The sale takes place every week from noon to 4 p.m. on the upper floor of the Redford Library, which is located between Telegraph and Beach Daily Roads at 25320 West 6 Mile Road. Come browse in a low-key setting the thousands of used books and small assortment of used CDs and DVDs that are available to purchase. The Friends of the Redford Library is an all-volunteer staff, so proceeds raised by the sale are used to pay for special programs for children and adults. So do something different on Saturdays. Enrich your mind while you contribute to a good cause. For more information, call 313-531-5960.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly show of green news you can use. Now, here's your host, Orly Cotell.
Welcome to Sierra Club Radio. We have a special Earth Day show for you this week. We're thrilled to have renowned architect William McDonough join us to talk about his new book, The Upcycle. We'll also speak with Andrea Lukey, the executive director of the Solar Foundation, about the rise in solar jobs. And Melissa Sun will talk with us about Sierra Club's Get Out campaign for Earth Day. A little over a decade ago, renowned architect William McDonough partnered with Michael Braungart to write a book called Cradle to Cradle, and it has become a seminal manifesto of green design. This month, his new book is being published, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance, and he's here to talk with us about it today. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. We're really honored to have you on as our guest, and I wanted to start by talking about the title. What does it mean to upcycle?
Well, it can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but we'd like to look at it as a quality question. And in Cradle to Cradle, we talked about the fact that most things that we call recycled today are actually downcycled. They're losing quality. If you mix all sorts of stuff together and make a park bench, it's an amalgam of food-grade plastics that have become sort of a hybrid on their way to a landfill or incinerator. So in Cradle to Cradle, we talked about upcycling as something like taking back a water bottle and improving its quality as we put it back into the world of plastics for the future generations. So that would just be plastics, but we see the same thing for the biosphere. You know, it would be great if things that would come back instead of being recycled, but they were toxic to begin with, like PVC things or lead containing things end up in the biosphere. If we could actually clean them up if they come back and put them back into endless resourcefulness, safe and healthy, it's improving the quality. And it works the same in life, and we can recycle things for biology, recycle things for technology, and also see it all as food and make it food for thought.
I think sometimes people have this perception that green design or green solutions are sparse, that they think going green might mean giving up that feeling of abundance. And yet you write about designing for abundance. What does that mean for you?
If we look at the issue of sustainability per se, and I asked you what's your relationship to your family or your spouse, and you said sustainable, I'd say I'm sorry. So the idea that we have a system that is destructive and we want to sustain it, or we talk about zero as a goal, it's as if we're just bad and we're trying to be less bad, but we're not saying what our goal is. And a zero means it's better if we're not here. So wouldn't it be nice if it was good if we were here? Well, that would mean we'd have a positive instead of a negative footprint. And that would mean we could honor the natural systems, which celebrate growth. So just to talk about things that are less bad is fine because it's reducing the demand on the environment of negative things. But really, we could talk about more good. And when we do that, we realize that nature uses solar energy to fuel biota, building soil. And carbon comes from the atmosphere into soil. That's the design. And things grow. And that's really the model, I think, for human productivity for the next century.
What are some examples of how we can apply that model?
Well, I do it in buildings since I'm trained as an architect. And I was asked by NASA to do their Mars station in part because they wanted to integrate our thinking into that project. And we decided in the end to do an Earth station first and then have a building like a tree on Earth. Imagine if you were an astronaut landing on Earth and you had all the experience from the space program. What would you do? If you looked around and said, I need energy, you wouldn't start digging holes looking for fossil fuels, and you wouldn't start building nuclear plants. You would look at the sun. It rises every morning, sets every evening. You say, oh, look, we have a nuclear reactor within easy reach, 93 million miles away. It's 8 minutes, and it's wireless. Let's go. And that's what NASA had done in space. They invented the photovoltaic. So if you stop and think about it, people say you don't need to be a rocket scientist to do something terrestrially. But what if we were? And then you realize that we've thought about all kinds of things that can work on the Earth and be like trees that are fecund, that grow things. So the building we've designed there has the potential to produce 120% of the energy it might need from renewable sources. And it honors the human intelligence, and it honors humility, because it did take us 5,000 years to put wheels on our luggage. In the meantime, we also went to the moon. So what if we put those together and with humility design buildings that can make, you know, renewable power into a source greater than that we need so we can share it? And that kind of design, I think, is what we can celebrate for the future. Because this was done with a normal budget on a normal schedule. So it's exciting.
In the book, you talk about speaking to the world in positives, and I really love that you have a chapter titled, Houston, We Have a Solution.
We did that when we started the NASA Space Station project, because I asked that the first meeting of our design team be in the room where they heard the words, you know, effectively, Houston, we have a problem. And so the idea that we'd take on a positive attitude and start moving that way is so much more interesting to me than just saying, woe is us, let's try to be less bad.
In the book, you also say that we don't have an energy problem. We have what you call a materials in the wrong place problem. Tell us a little bit more about that.
When people say we have an energy problem, therefore we have to drill, baby, drill, I think we're missing the fundamental point from a scientific perspective, as well as from a design perspective. We don't have an energy problem. We have lots of energy. It's actually mostly ancient solar income, or it's energy from various materials. But one of them is carbon. And over the millennia and the millions of years, even billions of years, we have seen carbon accrue to soil, and then it gets buried and pressurized, and we get hydrocarbons. But if we stop and think about it, we have a material problem. We have carbon, a material, in the atmosphere, where it's a toxin. A material is in the wrong place is a toxin. Lead in your baby's mouth is a neurotoxin. Lead in the computer or the telephone or the radio you're listening to is solder. if we release that into the biosphere, it becomes a neurotoxin because it's in the wrong place. So we have to be really careful to keep toxins in their place, away from biology in this case. And in the case of carbon, we love carbon. We are carbon. Trees are carbon. So what happened? We put it in the atmosphere where it really wasn't designed to be put. It was designed to be accrued in soil. And so that's the issue. We have plenty of energy. It's just that it's carbon-based. And then we're putting the carbon back into the atmosphere at parts per million that are problematic. So it's become a toxin. But that's because we did that. You know, you think about a tool. A tool doesn't know about its value. So when we say let's be less bad and reduce our carbon, well, less and bad are not numbers that multiply as negatives to a positive, because less is a relationship and bad is a human value. So you're bad, just less so. So if we only say we're going to reduce our carbon emissions as our goal, then it's we're going towards zero. Well, that's nice, but you just told me what we're not going to do. You haven't told me what to do. And so just getting less bad is not being good. And that's why we look at carbon and say, isn't it wonderful? We are carbon. Isn't carbon going to the soil? Wonderful. Aren't things growing? Wonderful. And things that destroy that are not. So that's why we say we don't have an energy problem. We have a material problem.
What are some of the most innovative and creative solutions that you've come across in your research and your work that you think would inspire our listeners?
Well, there's some things like on the material side, I'm very excited about mining phosphates from city sewage. Because growing up in the Orient as a baby, the farmers used to collect our sewage, take to the farms and compost it and make fertilizer in Japan after the Second World War. And so I always thought the city and the farms were, you know, one organism. And today we can extract phosphate and nitrogen and methane from sewage. And so instead of seeing them as sewage treatment plants, which pollute rivers, and we add chemicals, for example, we can see them as nutrient management systems. So we now see technologies that produce a 12% economic return, turning sewage into minerals. And it saves us having to go to Morocco for phosphate. Well, that's a strategic issue. And the cities make money instead of having taxes to handle sewage plants. They have fertilizer factories. And it's good for the city because it's not polluting with point source pollution. And it's good for the farmers because the fertilizers that come out, struvite in the case of phosphates, is a slow release little pearl of fertilizer. It takes a year to dissolve in some cases. Well, this is beautiful. So now the farmers have slow release fertilizer that doesn't pollute when it rains. So the city gets to make money. The farmers get fertilizer that's coming from a local source. It is slow release, and so the bays come back, the oysters come back, the crabs come back. So the people who live on fishing come back. And so it's a healing act. These are design ideas that are healing acts for the planet, and it honors the fact that, you know, 300 years ago we were looking at human rights and dignity and ended up with the 1700s and the Declaration of Independence in this country, and then that's obviously continues to evolve. And then we see the market economy show up in the 1800s, and it's so fine. We've got equity and economy and play. And then in the 1900s, we just trashed the joint. Unbelievable, with carbon fuels and whatever. And so it is time for the ecological century. Time is now. And those are the three legs of a sustaining world. It's equity, fairness, and economy, the markets, and it's ecology, our home. So it's the three. And we now need to pay very particular attention, especially to the third one.
In the foreword to the book, Bill Clinton writes that this is a book about creativity. So how can we get more of our best thinkers, designers, artists, all the creative forces in our society mobilized around reimagining our society to live sustainably, to treat this earth as our home? As you put it, beyond sustainability.
Well, I think for us, Cradle to Cradle provided the fulcrum for the Archimedean levers. You need both, as he pointed out, a fulcrum, a place that does not move, and a place to stand to apply your levers, and if you're going to move the earth. And I've seen major newspapers forget the fulcrum. They'll say you need a place to stand and a lever and you can move the world. But you can't. You can poke holes in it. So the fulcrum is in cradle to cradle. Let's make things that go back to soil safely. And if you're going to wear them on your body, make sure the inks and the dyes and the mordants and the fixatives are all safe for human contact and for contact in water and safe soil. Let's make sure technologies like polymers and we call technical nutrients, metals and things like that, can go back to make more of the computers or vehicles that we require or desire, you know, in a way that doesn't destroy the biology. So cradle to cradle calls for biological and technical nutrition. That's part of the part of it. Then we call for renewable power, clean water, social fairness, and reverse logistics. We also want to get the stuff back in coherent systems, which is quite delightful economically, by the way. So that's the fulcrum. If you can do that, cradle-to-cradle work, then the question is, where do you stand? And what we see is that all sustainability, like politics, is local. And so the place to stand is where you are. And you can apply your levers in this way to the things you see every day from where you are. And that's the call to action. And ask for products that are cradle-to-cradle certified now that we put in the public domain. Ask for safe, healthy things. Enjoy the fecundity of the earth and the power that comes from the sun. We now have solar collectors coming out of a commodity-based market at this point, at 80 cents a square foot or a watt. This is commodity now. I mean, we can afford to solar power ourselves in various forms very soon. It's just a matter of putting our will to it and aiming at it and calling for it, and it will happen because it's becoming very cost-effective.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
Just that I think that, you know, I'm so honored to be talking to the Sierra Club, because if you look at the Sierra Club as a way of looking at the world, it has always honored the environment as a fundamental fulcrum of all human behavior. And I think that's a critical place to understand. And so it's a privilege to be here.
Well, thanks so much. And it's been an honor talking with you today. You've been listening to William McDonough talk about his new book, The Upcycle, Beyond Sustainability, Designing for Abundance. Joining us now over the phone is Andrea Lukey, the Executive Director of the Solar Foundation. Welcome.
Hi, Orly. Thanks for having me today.
So, Andrea, your organization recently released the first ever state solar jobs map, which shows the number of jobs that the solar industry is providing in each state. Tell us, which states came out at the top of your list?
Right. Well, yeah, since the release of our National Solar Job Census 2012, which we put out last fall, this census provides the most credible national solar jobs number to date. We've generated very reliable state jobs numbers using thousands of data points and a combination of sources. We now have very, very robust solar jobs numbers for all 50 states. And the top 10 solar job states in 2012 are, in this order, California, Arizona, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, Colorado, New York, Texas, Michigan, and Ohio. California ranked number one in terms of state jobs and has more than four times the number of solar workers than Arizona, which holds the number two spot. And although Arizona's number two, last year it didn't fare as well, and this year it's experienced a surge in employment due to the completion of a number of utility-scale projects.
I think what's interesting about the list, too, is people often think of solar as being in places that they think of as sunny, like California. They might not realize that the solar industry is providing jobs in places like Michigan or Massachusetts, and New Jersey is doing quite well, too, right?
Absolutely, yeah. States not located in the so-called Sun Belt are making what I consider quite a splash: New Jersey, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New York, Michigan, Ohio. These states are all in our top 10, and none of them are considered particularly sunny states.
So what kind of growth does this reflect in terms of the solar industry's jobs compared to previous years?
Since we started tracking solar jobs in 2010, there's been an increase in 27%, which makes the solar industry one of the fastest growing industries in America. And just between 2011 and 2012, the solar industry grew by 13.2%. and currently employs 119,000 Americans. And this growth is 13.2%. growth represents 14,000 new solar workers.
How does that compare with growth in other industries right now?
Well, the industry, the solar industry is growing much, much faster than the overall economy, and even much faster than many other sectors within the economy. As I said, we had a 13.2% growth over last year. And during the same time, during the same period, employment in the overall U.S. economy grew by a mere 2.3%, while fossil fuel electric generation and coal mining lost jobs. And then if you compare our numbers with data from the BLS, the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we find that, and this is just a fun fact, that, that California now has more solar workers than actors, and that the solar industry in Pennsylvania employs over twice the number of people filling structural iron and steel worker positions.
That's amazing. So what does it mean to have a solar job? When we talk about solar workers, what kinds of jobs are you counting?
A solar job or a solar worker is defined as someone who spends at least 50% of their time supporting solar-related activities. The census series, the National Solar Job Census series, and this state jobs effort, we count jobs across four industry subsectors. We count jobs across installation, manufacturing, sales and distribution, project development, and then an other category that it's a little bit of a wild card category. It includes jobs in R&D, finance, legal, and some other things. So we're capturing the bulk of the jobs within the industry, and we consider these jobs to be direct jobs.
And it sounds like they aren't just jobs. Some of them are also careers. I mean, there are people who can make their living over the course of their lives working in the solar industry.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's a lot of different career paths for people who have entered the solar industry at the ground level. There's also opportunities for people to swoop in with a superior amount of experience in other sectors and other industries.
In your research for this report and to collect these data, what new insights did you come to about the solar markets and solar policies?
Well, and this is intuitive. This is probably nothing new, but we found that all of the top 10 solar job states have in common a collection of policy tools that are designed to support renewable energy and solar. Now this is not to say that legislation is not needed, because these top 10 states already have all the legislation that they need. No, that's not the case. But rather, there's a very clear link between smart policies and an increase in jobs. We also found that solar energy is an even more important source of employment in places like Arizona and Hawaii than in California. California has, 40,000 some solar jobs, but on a per capita basis, solar is more important in places like Arizona and Hawaii. And I think one of the most important insights we came across is that economies of scale are making our industry a lot more labor efficient. Since we started studying this in 2010, the number of workers that are required to install a megawatt of solar is about a third. So we're definitely becoming more efficient, and the residential market segment is the most labor intensive. But with scale, companies are becoming more efficient and less labor will be needed. Now, this is not to say that as labor intensities go down that jobs will be lost, but rather they'll be shifting around to different areas of the industry. And as the industry grows, there will be more jobs in areas like finance, legal, R&D, recycling, maintenance, and other jobs in the solar services.
Anything else you want to add for our listeners?
They can access the state solar jobs map and all its contents on our website, thesolarfoundation.org or solarstates.org. Of course, we're known for our labor market research, and our National Solar Job Census series is also on our website.
Well, thanks so much for joining us today. You've been listening to Andrea Lukey, the Executive Director of the Solar Foundation, talking about their new state solar jobs map. Joining us now is Melissa Sun from the Sierra Club to talk with us about some of the ways that the Sierra Club is celebrating Earth Day this year. Welcome.
Hi, Orly. Thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So tell us about how the Sierra Club is celebrating Earth Day this year. What's the theme?
So the Sierra Club is celebrating Earth Day all month long with a brand new campaign. It's called Get Out. And it's really a pretty simple premise. Statistics today say that the average American spends 90% of their time indoors. So we're really just trying to make it easy for people to unplug and get out.
Now, I hear that you have a special getaway this year to Hawaii as part of the Earth Day sweepstakes. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so there's a lot of different components to this campaign. At the heart of it is this microsite, sierraclub.org/getout. And on that site is a sweepstakes. So everybody should enter to win. It's 5 nights at the Four Seasons Resorts in Lanai in Hawaii, and it's absolutely fabulous. The resort is called Four Seasons Resort Lanai at Manele Bay. There's 2 nights there, and then there's 3 nights at Four Seasons Resorts Lanai at the Lodge at Kauai. Manele Bay is like the quintessential Hawaiian beach resort. It's set on a cliffside, is overlooking a protected marine preserve. It's got world-class water sports like snorkeling, diving, surfing, kayaking, deep-sea fishing. And the other resort is really more upcountry. It's like a big, expansive country mansion almost with lots of set amongst rolling countryside, and it's got a lot of outdoor activities like horseback riding and croquet and lawn bowling and stuff like that.
So it sounds like a real Hawaii experience.
It is. It's incredible, and it's free if you win, so everybody should try to just sign up there.
So it's at sierraclub.org/getout?
Yes. And also on that microsite, it's, like I said, our goal is to really make it easy for people to find ways to get out. The main part of that site is a feed of all the events that we have going on around the country, and it's really easy to use. You can just enter in your zip code, and then everything that's happening in your community pops up. It's super easy.
So there's ways to get outside locally just by typing in your zip code and you find a hike or some other outing near you?
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of different kinds of events. There's local hikes. There's local, like, trail building and service events. There's social outings and get-togethers. There's town hall meetings. There's rallies. There's all sorts of different ways. And then also something really interesting that we just started this year in partnership with eBay is that about a dozen of our chapters are setting up local collection events where people can come and drop off their old outdoor gear and sporting goods equipment, and the chapters get to resell it on eBay and keep 100% of the proceeds for their chapter.
That's great. There's also a celebrity auction happening on eBay to raise money for the Sierra Club Foundation for Earth Day. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so this is really exciting for me personally because I do entertainment relations for the club. A lot of celebrities support our cause, but, you know, they're very busy people. That a lot of them have given some really great experiences and items. They just started last week, so there's still a chance to bid. We have two waves going. Let me tell you some of the great items. We have a meet and greet with Jason Mraz at the America's Cup Pavilion. He's doing a one-time-only performance for America's Cup. That's on September 1st. So you get VIP early entrance, and you get to meet him backstage. Jessica Alba is doing a green nursery makeover for her company, The Honest Company. And all you do is send in your pictures and your questions about how to make your nursery healthy and more green for your baby, and she will send you back a personalized consult on how to do that. We have a ton of other really, really great items, signed scripts from MASH and Modern Family, a meet and greet with the Mythbusters, a hike with Evangeline Lilly in Hawaii, all kinds of really fabulous things.
Well, that's about all the time we have for today, but we're so glad to hear about this campaign, and we hope that our listeners will check out the website at sierraclub.org/getout. And thanks again, Melissa, for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Melissa Sun talking about the Sierra Club's Earth Day campaign. For more information, you can visit sierraclub.org/getout.
This has been Orly Kotel with Sierra Club Radio. To send us feedback about the show or to ask a question for Mr. Green, you can email us through our website at sierraclubradio.com.
You've been listening to Sierra Club Radio, a weekly program of green news you can use. For more information, visit sierraclubradio.com.
That?
Oh, that? It's my time machine.
Does it work?
Sure. Just hit this button.
Whoa! Whoa, dinosaurs. Cool.
Or we can go here.
Hey, that's Napoleon.
Oui.
Or we can go to the future.
Wow, hey, you have this nice house. Do I have a nice house?
No, you didn't save any money. Always spent it on vacations and stuff.
If only there was a way I could go back in time and correct that bad habit.
Yep.
Okay, the time machine is not real, but the saving thing is. Get in the habit of putting some of your money in savings each week through a 401k, savings account, or financial investments. Put away a few bucks, feel like $1 million. For free ideas and easy tips on saving, go to feedthepig.org. That's
feedthepig.org. What does this crazy little button do?
No! This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a Friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
Ford Community College gift cards are a great way to show your support for someone in your life who is seeking the skills necessary to fulfill their dreams. Available in values from $10 to $100, gift cards can be used towards payment of tuition, purchasing books and supplies, lab fees, or even a lunch at Skylight Cafe. Gift cards can be purchased at the campus bookstore or online at collegestore.hfcc.edu. College gift cards. What better way to encourage a student in your life than with an investment in their future?
You feel petrified. You're struggling with your mortgage payments, not knowing what to do. You do nothing. But if you do something, you're far more likely to get the most positive outcome. Making Home Affordable is a free government program. Call 888-995-HOPE to talk one-on-one with a housing expert about your options. Call 888-995-HOPE or visit makinghomeaffordable.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Treasury, HUD, and the Ad Council.
Metro Detroit is going down every single Monday night, 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. The Zone Radio with Richardson, D.C., only here at 89.3. The station making waves across the Great Lakes, WHFR.FM. That's right, Detroit's longest running hip-hop show, The Zone Radio with Richardson, D.C.
Live at the Planetary Defense Conference, this week on Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier, and this week to Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, Arizona. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society, and last week I joined Bill Nye, Bruce Betts, and several hundred scientists at the PDC, the biannual Planetary Defense Conference. Today we'll begin 2 weeks of special coverage, beginning with excerpts of a panel discussion I moderated in front of nearly 1,000 rabid fans of planetary science and Bill Nye. The hardest part of creating our show each week is deciding what to leave out. It was an especially difficult task this time, since I only have time to share about a quarter of the outstanding discussion with Bill and four passionate scientists. You can hear and see much more almost the entire evening at planetary.org/radio. We videotaped the event, which included not just the panel, but special presentations by both Bill Nye and Jeffrey Notkin of the great Meteorite Men reality show on the Science Channel. Our own Bruce Betts hosted the night, and Bruce announced the latest winners of Shoemaker Near-Earth Object Grants from the Planetary Society. You'll hear Bruce and me with an onstage version of What's Up in a few minutes. We weren't the only people on the road. Let's check in with planetary evangelist Emily Lakdawalla. As you'll hear, we could only connect with Emily by cell phone this time. Emily, I think we've caught you on your plane as it's just about to leave New York City. Tell us about this press conference that you hosted this morning in New York.
Well, it's a group of dreamers who call themselves the Mars One Project. They think they're going to get humans to land on Mars in 2023.
Aren't they proposing a one-way trip?
They are talking about a one-way trip, and that's a little scary to contemplate. I'm not volunteering, but there are an awful lot of people who are interested, and so that's actually what they were announcing today, is the opening of the astronaut application process.
So how did you end up hosting this?
They invited me, and I was pleased to do it because they are certainly a bunch of excited, passionate people who believe in the cause that they've started here. And I've had a pleasure of talking with them over the last couple of days about their ideas and their plans. They do have to get going quite quickly, though. They're talking about the first launch with supplies being in 2016, and that's right around the corner.
Tell us a little bit more about what they plan to do.
Well, they have to launch several supply ships first, and they'll wind up with two rovers on the surface before they get humans there. Set up some basic, very tiny habitation. They're going to use larger inflatable modules once they get people there. But, of course, they also have to do this astronaut preparation process. They say it's going to take 7 years to train their team of astronauts. And they're looking for about 40 people in the end who are going to go through this process in teams of four, and only one of those teams is going to get to launch.
Tell us, what do you think? Is this just crazy, or is this the most exciting thing to come along in a long time?
I don't think they're crazy, and I do think that the first mission to Mars is going to look something like this one. But I'm not sure if this is the group that is going to accomplish it. We'll just have to wait and see. It's really all about money. Will enough people believe in them to give them the billions of dollars that it's going to cost in order to get this going? They say they're going to fund it through essentially reality TV programming surrounding the selection and training of these astronauts. I think that the devil's in the details. We'll just have to wait and see if other people believe in them enough to write really big checks.
Are you going to be writing a little bit more about your experience with the Mars One team when you get back?
Yes, I will.
Excellent. We'll watch for that. And we'll also point out that you can read something from Emily right now about Mars. It's a walk among some very interesting, strange terrain. How do you pronounce this term for these mesas?
They're called mensae. It's just the Latin word for, based on the Latin word for table. And that's what a mesa is a table. So it's all the same thing.
It is a April 19 entry in the blog, in Emily Lakdawalla's blog at planetary.org. And we invite you to take a look. Emily, have a great trip, and we'll talk to you soon after you get back.
Thank you, Matt.
She is Emily Lakdawalla, the senior editor for the Planetary Society and our planetary evangelist, as well as a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. I will be right back with the first of our coverage from the Planetary Defense Conference in Flagstaff, Arizona, just last week. Welcome back to Planetary Radio. We're at the Planetary Defense Conference on the campus of Northern Arizona University, here among the pines. Here in beautiful Flagstaff, Arizona. It's here for Flagstaff. Go Lumberjacks! So you can hear them. More than 900 people have crowded into Prochnow Auditorium to hear the Meteorite Men and the CEO of the Planetary Society, my boss, Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Welcome, Bill.
Thanks, Matt. It's a fantastic room, fantastic, may I say, energy. And,
yeah.
Really appreciate everybody coming out. I think we have the future of near-Earth object exploration here, and I think we will, dare I say it, change the world.
You just finished a great presentation. It will be, along with everything else from this evening, on the Planetary Society website at planetary.org. Bill, you and I are joined on stage by four outstanding young men and women of science. Each is already a leading light in humanity's effort
to understand these millions of smaller objects in our solar system and making sure that we don't suffer the fate of the dinosaurs when we find one of those big rocks that happens to have our name on it. We've got very few minutes to talk with them about their work and what drives them. So I'm going to start introducing them, beginning with somebody who's from right here in Flagstaff. That's David Trilling. David, please. David is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at Northern Arizona University. Much of his research focuses on the formation and evolution of planetary systems like our own solar system. He relies on both ground and space-based telescopes and on archive data gathered, some of it many years ago. David's work on near-Earth asteroids includes observations with the Spitzer Space Telescope, the infrared-seen sister to the Hubble. Just last week, his team obtained data for a new Spitzer program that will find small near-Earth asteroids. And small, in this case, is a relative term. A small asteroid can ruin your whole day. David heads the local organizing committee for the Planetary Defense Conference, which brought us all of us here this week. He's teaching a class on planetary defense this semester. Please welcome David Trilling.
Thank you, Matt.
David, I get the feeling maybe a few of your students are here with us tonight.
I think so.
Are they also attending the conference?
Many of them are. The ones from the class I'm teaching are also attending the conference and talking with people from around the world, learning a lot, I hope.
Nice opportunity, isn't it? Talk to all these experts from all over the
world. It was very convenient for all these people to come all around the world to help teach my class this semester.
And there will be a quiz after this evening?
Yes, that's right.
So let's move on. Bill, you'll be glad to hear there's a fellow engineer with us on the stage. Brent Barbie is a flight dynamics engineer at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center. He also teaches in the aerospace engineering program at the University of Maryland. He recently edited a report on an international workshop called Target NEO, N-E-O. And he co-authored the Near-Earth Object Human Spaceflight Accessible Target Study, or NHATS. Do I have that right, Brent?
Actually, the correct pronunciation is NATS.
NATS. Yes. They're flitting around. Which has provided a baseline for a human mission to an asteroid or comet. Among his many presentations is Get Rich or Go Extinct, the Asteroid Business Case. Please welcome Brent Barbie to Planetary Radio. Brent, the title of that presentation leads me to ask, are you encouraged by the presence of now not one, but two private companies that intend to get rich mining asteroids?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think one of them said, I think it was the one that formed more recently, Deep Space Industries, they said, you know, one company trying to do this is an anomaly, two is an industry.
So. And competition to drive it as well. Kathy Plesko is a research scientist in applied physics at Los Alamos National Laboratory. She uses the supercomputers there to study what happens when asteroids and comets hit a planet and how to prevent them from hitting one in particular, our own. She was a teenager when she became interested in asteroids and comets. Kathy was awarded her PhD in geophysics and planetary sciences just 4 years ago. That was at UC Santa Cruz, where she studied the effects that large asteroid and comet impacts had on the climate of Mars early in the history of the solar system. She has also studied asteroid impact mitigation and uses those supercomputers to model how we might use a nuclear explosion. You've seen that in the movies, right? But not to break up a huge space rock, but just to deflect it just enough so that it misses our home planet, something that Brent Barbie has also worked on. Kathy, welcome to Planetary Radio.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
How important is the role that supercomputers play in our ability to understand near-Earth objects and what we can do about them?
That's a great question. So supercomputers are actually really important for studying the impact hazard mitigation problem. So with a supercomputer, we can make these beautiful, sophisticated models of exactly what happens during an impact, and we can look inside of it in ways that we could never do with actual instrumentation, or we couldn't send people to it. And so it's like having a big crystal ball, but with real math and physics. It's awesome. We can use them to model things that are too risky to do. We can model things that are too far away. Using a supercomputer, I've actually been for a walk on Mars. It was the coolest thing ever. We got some of the rover data from Endeavour Crater, and we fed it into a virtual reality room that we have at Los Alamos, and four of my colleagues and I actually got to go walking through Endeavour Crater as if we were really there, except it was warm and comfortable and we had coffee.
The holodeck is here, apparently.
Yes.
And obviously, supercomputers are so powerful now, you don't need one that's more powerful than what you've got, right?
You know,
that's a joke.
The computers we have are great, and we have wonderful ways of tricking them into being even faster than they really are. But, you know, if you're driving a Ferrari and you've got a chance to get the keys to a Learjet or, you know, maybe a stealth bomber, you take the chance.
More to come. Let's hope Moore's Law holds up for a while longer. The last person for me to introduce is sitting next to me, Amy Mainzer. Didn't know it until a few minutes ago, but she's already been on Planetary Radio a couple of times in the last few months, most recently when she was part of a NASA press conference about the NEOWISE mission. She is principal investigator for this effort that builds on the success of an amazing spacecraft called WISE. That's the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. And Amy has been its deputy project scientist for 10 years. She's a principal scientist in the astrophysics and space sciences section at the Jet Propulsion Lab, where she's also principal investigator for another mission, a perspective mission, I guess. That's NEOCAM, or the Near Earth Object Camera, which was selected for technology development funding in 2011. Maybe we'll hear more about that a little bit later. NASA gave her its Exceptional Scientific Achievement Medal in 2012. Please help me welcome Amy Mainzer. So this is one of those questions that we broadcasters ask, even though we already know the answer, because it's such an impressive answer. How many asteroids and comets has WISE discovered?
Well, WISE was, I like to say it's small but mighty, and in 1 year of surveying, we were able to discover about 34,000 asteroids.
Never before seen, never before known about.
We have a lot of names to give out.
And there's so much more that we could say about WISE, because this thing has done all this work with little objects in our solar system, but it's done things out at the outer reaches of the universe, right?
Yeah, that's one of the fun things about making a map of the entire sky. You never know what you're going to find. Things all the way at the edge of the universe and things that are literally right next door to us. It's been a fun mission.
So you can see a very distinguished group that we have up here. What is the project that you're involved with, or hope to be involved with very soon, that really has you fired up? And Amy, I'm going to start with you, because I think you may already have alluded to this.
Well, sure. I mean, I would like to go out and survey for more hazardous asteroids. That would be a wonderful thing, and I think it'd be sort of useful to do. But that said, I'm just really happy and so grateful that I have a career working with some of the coolest stuff and coolest people on the planet. So thank you.
Brent Barbee.
One of them you already mentioned, which is the NATS project. So NASA has a wonderful near-Earth object program website, neo.jpl.nasa.gov. It has a lot of great information on it. And one of the things on that website is a web page for our NATS study. So we're looking for all the asteroids out there that are potentially accessible for future spaceflight missions. So this is very analogous to the way that we monitor the population to be sure that we're aware of all the ones that pose any threat of impacting the Earth. Now we're also monitoring the population automatically every day for all those that present opportunities for exploration, just like we monitor for those that present the risk of impact. So I encourage you guys to check that out on the website. That's a project that I enjoy a great deal. And the other project that I'm working on is a it's funded by the NASA Innovative Advanced Concepts Program, or NIAC, and I'm working with my colleagues at the Asteroid Deflection Research Center at Iowa State University, and we're working on designing a hypervelocity asteroid intercept vehicle, which we hope to one day put through its paces in test flights and prove that we've got what it takes to stop a hazardous asteroid before it hits us.
With a nuke, paging Bruce Willis here. That was a great presentation that you and your colleagues made earlier today. So, that was Brent Barbee of the Goddard Space Flight Center. Kathy Plesko, Los Alamos.
Planetary defense is it. This is so exciting and such an amazing time where we're not just talking necessarily anymore about, oh, we should maybe do this if we get the technology, but Brent's building this spacecraft, Amy's looking for these objects, and I'm modeling what to do if. And so, I mean, we can observe an earthquake. We can predict where a hurricane's going to land. We can stop an asteroid from hitting the Earth. This is the first time in the history of history that we can actually prevent a natural disaster.
Yeah. And David Trilling of this university that has hosted us this evening.
We have a little bit of science ADD in my group. We're doing everything we can think of here, there, asteroid discovery, characterization. Somebody discovers it, the next night we want to go and observe it and find out what it's made out of and get us on that path to understanding more about that asteroid. But there's a bigger picture, which is that here in Flagstaff and in every other town in this country, asteroids have been on the front page of the newspaper a lot of times already in 2013. And so as long as people's awareness is up and people are interested in talking about asteroids, we'll continue to do fun and interesting things.
David Trilling of Northern Arizona University. Bill, I'm going to get some closing words from you in a moment, but I hope that all of you here who, first of all, that you were as impressed and excited to hear these folks as I have been. Please help me thank our outstanding onstage guests, Brent Barbee, Amy Mainzer, Kathy Plesko, and David Trilling. Just a sampling of my terrific conversation with Bill Nye and those four great explorers on the evening of April 17 in Flagstaff, Arizona. The public event was part of the Planetary Defense Conference. You can watch all 3.5 hours of that amazing night on the Planetary Society YouTube channel and in our multimedia section at planetary.org. We'll hear more from the conference itself next week, and we'll return to that Northern Arizona University stage in a minute for What's Up with Bruce Batten.
I'm just trying to trim a little time, but okay.
He's trying to save time. Right. He's the I don't give now. A damn. He's the overall moderator, so he's got to save time. All right, I'm turning over here to Zach. Hi, Zach. Welcome.
Hi.
How old are you, Zach?
8.
And who are you here with today?
My dad.
Yeah? Is he out there now? Dad, give us a wave. There he is. Do you remember your job, Zach? Are you ready? Here we go. Really loud. 1, 2, 3, go.
Random space fact.
Well done, Zach. Thank you so much. You can walk back over there and rejoin your dad now. I can see the eagerness in all your eyes. We're going to give you a shot, too. You ready? 1, 2, 3.
Random space fact.
Wow.
That's awe-inspiring.
That is awesome.
So speaking of asteroids, as we're doing all this evening, and near-Earth asteroids, those that come within 1.3 AU, or astronomical units, Earth-Sun distances of the Sun, they're estimated to be about 20,000 near-Earth asteroids that are larger than 100 meters. Something to ponder.
Yeah, and be frightened of.
Well, I wouldn't lose sleep tonight, but we need to do stuff about it. We should have a conference. All right, we move on to the trivia contest, and we asked you last time about the mirror coatings of the Chandra X-ray Observatory. What is the coating material of the mirrors on Chandra X-ray Observatory. How'd we do, Matt?
Excellent response. A lot of people who wanted to get, because the prize for people who listen to the show is currently Bill Nye's voice on your answering system. So, personalized, of course. Do you remember where our winner was from last week?
No.
Norway.
Getting a test? Really?
Do you know where our winner is from this week, chosen by random.org?
No, of course I don't.
Norway!
Wow.
It's freaky.
We're huge in Norway. Scandinavia in general.
They do seem to like us there. Ellen Kjellman. Ellen Kjellman of Vinterbro, Norway, who said that the reflecting surface on Chandra's mirrors is a 33-nanometer coating of iridium.
Indeed, iridium.
Excellent. Well, Ellen, I don't think he speaks Norwegian, but you're going to get Bill Nye's voice on your answering system. I got to mention Kev Knowles of New Zealand, the land of the long white cloud. He actually got it right as well, but he also considered answering unobtainium, kryptonite, and not iridium, but the crushed remains of 100,000 iridium satellite phones.
You know, those were all under consideration. They opted not to. All right, now, you need to tell me, do you want the radio contest for next week question first, or the audience
question? Let's save the radio one and give away some stuff to these people here.
All right. Oh, Matt is now modeling a lovely recent version of the Planetary Radio T-shirt. Give us 30 minutes.
Soon to be a collector's item, because the new one is being designed right now, so...
Yeah, they'll be worth a fortune. But we're not only giving away that. Each winner of our contest this evening will also receive a copy of the Planetary Report, the Planetary Society official magazine that goes to members. But wait, don't order yet. They're all autographed by Bill Nye.
All right, let's go.
All right, here's our first question, and we've got some local ones, so I just went out to the beautiful Meteor Crater today. Approximately how long ago did Meteor Crater form? Ballpark. If you have a degree in the space sciences or related, you are not eligible.
What about David Trilling's students?
Oh, that's up to you.
We got somebody. Hi there, what's your name, sir?
David.
David, what's the answer?
Oh, God. Oh, God.
No, that is not the answer. Let's go over here now. Thank you.
50,000 years old.
I'm sorry, what?
50,000 years old?
That is correct.
Yeah! Give that man a shirt and a Planetary Report.
Continuing on in our Meteor Crater theme, the object that came slamming in and forming Meteor Crater, what was it primarily made of?
Hi, sir.
Yes, iron. Iron nickel meteorite.
Congratulations.
Sticking with the and was instrumental in determining not only its origin for sure, its impact, but also lunar craters and lots of other stuff. We'll mention that later. But for those of you listening to the radio show, go to planetary.org/radio contest to submit your entry.
You need to get us that entry. By Monday, that'd be Monday, the 29th of April at 2 p.m. Pacific time. We are done.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about big, giant things flying down and slamming into the Earth. Thank you, and good night.
He is Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. He joins us every week here for What's Up. Remember that you can watch that What's Up session and all the other great stuff that happened on stage during the April 17 public event at the Planetary Defense Conference. Our special coverage of the conference continues next week when we'll talk with astronauts Ed Liu and Rusty Schweikert of the B612 Foundation, Laser Bees researcher Allison Gibbings, and astronomer Carolyn Shoemaker, widow of the great Gene Shoemaker. We'll also join an exciting simulation of how humanity may meet the challenge of a killer asteroid. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation and by the highly defensive members of the Planetary Society. Clear skies.
Debbie Ray, I mean Taylor.
WHFR Dearborn.
Dig deeper. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area on the new WHFR Journal every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. and anytime as a podcast from WHFR.fm. Join our WHFR news team as we dig deeper, making waves.
I'm Joanne Korchunska. Please join me on Fridays, 2 to 6 p.m., as I cruise with the blues down Highway 61 on WHFR.fm, the station making waves.
Oh, yeah.